So I have a text for you this morning. It is the words of Hannah. Very simple words. I asked the Lord for him. I asked the Lord for him. There is nothing ambiguous about the words. There isn't one word that we do not know the meaning of. There is nothing complicated about this little text that I present to you this morning. Simply the words of Hannah, I asked the Lord for him. Some of our conversations may sometimes be ambiguous. We do not quite know what the other person is trying to convey to us. Sometimes we see notices around which are ambiguous, and we do not quite know what they are intended to convey. We were travelling up, for example, from Wiltshire recently, and all along the Foss Way you will find notices tied to trees or other things which say, bikers beware. Now I don't know, you may know, but I don't know whether it's the bikers that are to beware or whether it's the motorists that are to beware of the bikers. It is ambiguous. We have an advertisement at the beginning of our village in Shearsby which says LIVE on the green on the 8th of August. LIV on the green. What does it mean? Now, we've been in Shearsby long enough to know that it doesn't mean that people are coming to live on the green. They're having live music on the green. But I wish that they would say so. Otherwise, we may have tents spreading up on the green one of these days. Live on the green. Live on the green. There's nothing ambiguous, my dear friends, about what this text tells us. I asked the Lord for him. I want to speak for a moment or two about the people involved in this story. And when I use the word story, I'm not using it in the sense of a fairy story or something which is made up. This is a very important part of history. It is not a fairy story, it is a narrative of a series of events. And they have to do with a number of different people. There are mainly seven of them, four men and two women and a little child. There is, on the female side, Peninnah, one of the wives of Elkanah, and Hannah, his other wife. Peninnah and Hannah make up the female part of this group of people around which this story is woven. And then, in addition to these two women, Peninnah and Hannah, there are four men. There is Eli, and Hophni, and Phinehas, away yonder in Shiloh, and there is Elkanah in Ramathem Zophim, and then there is the little boy. Four men and two women. Of the two women, we can say that one of them was a godly woman. Hannah was a godly lady. The other was not so godly. Peninnah was a destructive, disruptive, unkind, uncouth kind of woman. She was a tormentor, as Hannah described her. So there you have the two women, one a godly woman and the other not so godly. Amongst the men, you have two men who are godly men, Elkanah in Ramathem Zophim and Eli the priest of the Lord in Shiloh. And then you have two not so godly sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, and you have a little boy. It's as if this little group of people are representative of the chosen, called people of God under the Old Covenant. Some of God's people under the Old Covenant were godly people. Some of them were not so godly, and they were little children. It's also as if this little group of people is representative of a group of people under the New Covenant. For in the gathering together of God's people in what we call a church, you will find that there are a number of godly people whose godliness reflects the holiness of Christ, and there are some others who are not so godly and occasionally seek to disrupt the family of Christ, and then there are little children. So here in this picture, this history, this story, this group of people representing the groups in the Old Testament covenant, the Old Covenant, and possibly also we can picture them as representative of the gathering together in a group that we call the church. But then there's some places as well as people. For Elkanah and Hannah and Peninnah and all her children lived in Ramathaim Gophim in the Zophim, in the hill country to the north of Canaan. And Shiloh was about 30 miles or so east of Ramathaim Zophim and about 10 miles south of Bethel. So here was a family in Ramathaim traveling some 30 or so miles for the annual celebrations and festivals in Shiloh under the direction of Eli and Hophni and Phinehas. But Shiloh had been established at the beginning of the entry into Canaan. The people of God had come after their captivity and wandering in the wilderness under the leadership of Joshua into the land of Canaan, as God had promised they would. And slowly they percolated northwards until they arrived at the hill country of Ephraim, where many of them were established. And a tent of meeting, or a place of meeting, was established for them in Shiloh. Eventually, by the time we come to the story of Samuel, the temporary place of meeting had become a permanent establishment with priests as Eli and Hophni and Phinehas. So you have these people, some of which are resident in Ramathaim Zophim and some who are working in the temple at Shiloh. And they come together at a vitally important period of, or time of, Hebrew history. For this birth of Samuel occasion, this event when Samuel was born, marks the end of the period when God's people have been ruled by judges, and at the beginning of the time when the people of God are going to be ruled by a series of kings, Saul and David and Solomon, and then by a divided kingdom ruled by kings, good and otherwise. So here at 1 Samuel 1 is a a vital part, a vital time in the history of God's people. At the time when this woman, Hannah, desired to have a son, and God desired to have a servant who would be the first of the prophets and lead into the rule of kingdoms. But this story, or this series of events, has to do with the great subject of prayer. For Hannah was a woman who was urgently beseeching the Lord for him to give to her a son. And so she said, "I asked the Lord for him." And in the fullness of time, God gave to Hannah what she had requested, and Samuel was born. So we are dealing with the subject of prayer in the context of the sovereignty of God. Remember how this passage that we're looking at refers to God as the Lord Almighty, and Hannah refers to God as the Lord Almighty. She was recognizing that God was the Lord, that is, the Lord who lives and reigns, and that he was almighty. There was nothing that he could not do. So we're looking just for a moment or two at the subject of prayer, taking Hannah as an example, under the doctrine of the sovereignty of God. For all prayer is subject to the sovereignty of God. You will remember that Paul has some very important words to write to the Philippians. He writes, "Do not be anxious for anything, but in everything make your requests known unto God, or offer your petitions to God with thanksgiving, and the peace of God will rule in your hearts." So when we Christian people have anxieties and cares and worries and disturbances and people that offend us, all of these things we can bring to the Lord Almighty, the sovereign God, in our prayers. The first thing then that I want to say, and there aren't many of them, the first thing that I want to say is this, that prayer is not optional. It is essential for the Christian. Paul says, "Do not be anxious, but in everything make your petitions known unto God." It was Campbell Morgan, who was the predecessor of Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones at Westminster Chapel, who was asked after a Keswick message that he had given on prayer. He said that somebody said to him, "Dr. Morgan, how much do you pray?" And he thought for a moment and looked and said, "As you are probably meaning prayer, not very much. But as I understand prayer, all of the time." Campbell Morgan was a man of constant prayer. And that is how it ought to be. each event of the day, each opening, each closing may be the opportunity for offering to God our prayers of the heart. It was James Montgomery, the hymn writer, we've just sung his hymn, "Lord, teach us how to pray aright, with reverence and with fear. Though dust and ashes in thy sight, we may, we must draw near." So that prayer is not an option, it is an essential. Prayer is the soul's sincere desire, uttered or unexpressed, the motion of a hidden fire that's kindled in the breast. Prayer is an essential. But prayer is offered to a God who is sovereign, the Lord Almighty, and sometimes he may say to us, yes. Sometimes he may say to us, no. And sometimes he may say to us, wait a little while. For Hannah, it was both no and wait for a little while, for she had prayed for some years in the face of Peninnah's torment and in the face of her desire to be able to have a son. So she came to the Lord with a kind of covenant, if you like. Lord, if you will give to me a son, I will give him back to you so that he may be your servant. And God gave to her a little child, Samuel, the name belonging to the Lord. Samuel. He was born to her in the fullness of time, in the sovereignty of God, in the perfect will of God, in order that God's will shall be accomplished. You know, sometimes God's sovereignty works to promote, sometimes God's sovereignty works to prevent, and sometimes God's sovereignty works to submit. God's sovereignty works to allow or permit. You can see those aspects of God's sovereignty working, for example, in the life of Jonah. God has a purpose to promote. He desires to promote the truth about himself in the city of Nineveh. That is his purpose. He therefore calls the man called Jonah and permits him for a time to go his own way. But he prevents him from dying in the sea by providing a way of escape until God's will is perfected when Jonah eventually arrives where he ought to have been in Nineveh. So you can see God promoting his purposes, God permitting Jonah to go his way, God preventing Jonah from ending his purpose, and ultimately God's purpose is achieved, or better, accomplished. Now you can see the same aspects of God's sovereignty in the coming of Christ. In the councils of the Trinity in heaven, before anything else, there was a purpose declared that God would send his Son into the world, that the world through him might be saved, that the pardon for sin, that forgiveness of sin, that atoning for sin should be accomplished on the cross and in the resurrection. That was his purpose. But he permitted in his sovereignty, See, God was still exercising his sovereignty when Judas treacherously betrayed Christ, and when the high priest clamored for his death, and when the soldiers nailed him to the cross. His purpose was not laid aside. He was simply permitting human activity to run its course, until he prevented his purposes from ending by bringing his son back again to life, so that death should not end his purpose. And Jesus rose from the dead, and the purposes of God in his son were accomplished. His purposes, his permission, and his prevention accomplished his will. And that is how we are to view, I believe, the biblical doctrine of the sovereignty of God. And all our prayers are to be aligned, as well as we are able, with the help of the Spirit. For we do not always know how to pray as we ought, but the Spirit helps us in our infirmities, so that we are brought into line with the ultimate purposes of God. Sometimes he will say yes and answers come. Sometimes he will say no. Sometimes he will say wait, as he did for Hannah. And then the little child is born. To become a great man in the purposes of God, a great servant of the Lord in the temple, a great man in the vanguard of the kingship that would rule over his people. I wonder how Elkanah and Hannah viewed their little child as they looked at him in whatever cot he had in Ramathaim. Could they possibly know, I ask, could they possibly know what God was going to do with this little child as they presented him to the Lord in Shiloh? 1707, in the rectory at Epworth in Lincolnshire, Samuel and Susanna Wesley looked at their little child that had just been born. They had called him Charles. How could they possibly know what God would do with this little child that had been dedicated to him? How could they possibly know what God was going to do with this child, Charles? They could not possibly know that he was going to become one of England's greatest hymn writers. Or in 1714, as the Whitfield man and wife in the inn at Gloucester looked at their little child that they had called George and dedicated him to the Lord, how could they possibly know what God was going to do with their little son? We know that God took that little child, George, born in such circumstances in Gloucester in 1714, and raised him up to be one of England's greatest evangelists. They couldn't have known, as they dedicated him to the Lord. Or think of the Taylor family in Barnsley, 1734. No relation, I have to say. Proven fact, no relation. But there they were, the Taylor couple over their chemist shop in the unprepossessing town of Barnsley, looking at their little child that they had dedicated to the Lord, James Hudson Taylor. How could they know that God was going to take this little child and make him into one of the greatest pioneer missionaries of the Christian church? but they dedicated him to the Lord and the Lord took him and used him. Or you think of the Spurgeon family in Kelvedon in Essex some years later, looking at their little child that they had called Charles Haddon. How could they know that God was going to take hold of that little child and raise him to be one of England's greatest preachers? Couldn't know. It is therefore my final point this morning, that what God gives to us in answer to our prayers, we are to return to him with thanksgiving. Do not be anxious, dear friends, but make your requests known unto God with thanksgiving, and the peace of God will rule in your hearts. Whatever the Lord gives to you in the way of his gracious gifts, will you please present your gifts back to him so that he may use them for his eternal purposes and his eternal glory. Thank you for listening so carefully to the story of Hannah. I asked the Lord for him and little Samuel, who became such a great man in the purposes of God.